Well, hello, everyone. I'm James Dobson, and you're listening to Family Talk, a listener-supported ministry. In fact, thank you so much for being part of that support for James Dobson Family Institute.
In a culture warped by secularism and saturated with religious hatred, Christians and Jews must recognize their commonalities. These two faiths share a great deal of moral virtues, which of course are rooted in Scripture. Today, we'll learn more about these similarities through the conclusion of Dr. Dobson's conversation with Rabbi Daniel Lappin. He is an Orthodox Jew, a popular author, and a respected radio host. Rabbi Lappin was a native of South Africa before immigrating to the United States in 1973. He is a popular writer, with his publications appearing in the Wall Street Journal and National Review. In just a moment, Rabbi Lappin and Dr. Dobson will continue discussing Israel and examine the historic Abrahamic Accords. The two will then return to the idea of marriage and why this institution is vital to society. There's a lot of content to get to, so let's get underway right now. Here again is our host, Dr. James Dobson.
Let's talk again about Israel itself, which just fascinates me. What do you think about the U.S. Embassy being moved to Jerusalem?
I really think it tells us a lot about Donald Trump. Partially, they hate him because he keeps his word. He's not behaving like a politician. He's behaving like a successful businessman. You don't have a long and happy career in business if you keep breaking your word. But politician after politician, president after president, treats the American Jewish community as the dumb body politic it is, promises them they're going to move the embassy, and then actually never does it. This has been a tired old song. And as a matter of fact, two-thirds of American Jews were horrified that President Trump actually moved the embassy. They warned against it. So you and I are really on the opposite side of two-thirds of American Jews. It's just a reality. So the really fascinating thing about Israel, and this is true when you look at all countries, the general rule in the West, fertility has declined to below replacement levels. The only people who are having children in Europe are Muslims. The Italians are not having children. The French are not. The Germans, the Scandinavians, Norwegians, Swedish, Danes, none of them. The British, not having children. Only their immigrant populations are having children. In the United States, it's a lot healthier because, after all, we still do have a substantial part of our population. God bless them, evangelical Christians, serious Catholics, wonderful. Israel is a standout in the West. Israel is the only Western country with a very high fertility rate, where replacement, as you know, is about 2.1 children per woman. Israel's about 8 children per woman.
Really?
They're popping kids out all the time.
And I didn't know that.
It's so wonderful that you can walk in the streets in Israel. You know, I haven't been there since the COVID started, but under normal circumstances, walk through the streets of New York, walk through the streets of Boulder, walk through the streets of Miami. You don't see kids. You see middle-aged and old people. That's all you see. You don't see little kids. In Israel, I mean, you stop in any Israeli city, you stop at a crosswalk waiting for the light to go green. And it's happened to us countless times. It happens to people all the time. You're standing there waiting. Some little kid you've never seen in your life before will come and slip his or her hand into yours, because the mother told them you must hold an adult's hand when you cross the street. And they'll hold your hand to cross the street, and then when you get to the other side, they run off. They're all over the place. It is primarily a deep, visceral confidence in the future that comes from a God-centric worldview that makes you have kids. And secularism has the seeds of its own expiration built into it.
Hey, talk about the recent peace deal between the state of Israel and its Arab neighbors in the Middle East that took place.
We once had a president in this country who got a peace prize for doing absolutely nothing.
That's true.
If that president would have put together even a half of this historic peace, the Abraham Accords, done by President Trump, they would have cast a completely new glorious medal for him. The fact that it was done by this president renders it not only unworthy of comment, but even worthy of criticism. The fact is, it is huge. The fact that Saudi Arabia is going to allow tourism flights between Tel Aviv and Abu Dhabi there is no way to measure. And this, again, is an old Jewish principle. And that is that trading with one another, money is one of the ways of bringing people together. It's a wonderful way of bringing people together, because when we trade with one another, we benefit mutually, and we don't want to hurt one another. We actually want to help one another. So those states are not focused on Arab-Israeli problems. They're focused on making a dollar. You can work with people like that. People who are seeking political power, I don't know how to deal with them. What am I supposed to do? Grease their palms or promise to vote for them? I don't know what works. But when I'm dealing with somebody who's trying to make a living, it's a pleasure. It's very simple. If you can do something for me, if you can provide me with an object that'll enhance my life, I will willingly and voluntarily open my pocket and give you money for it. And we part on the best of terms. That's why American shopkeepers often say to their customers at the end of the transaction, have a nice day, because it's friendly. And so this is massive. It looks like Morocco will open up to this Abraham Accord soon. Israel has many, many Israelis of Moroccan ancestry. The tourism and the joint development, the alliance on security will be massive. The alliance on tourism will be massive. The alliance on development in areas like irrigation and agriculture will be amazing. It's opening up a very exciting time. And in the last 70 years, probably never been a better time to be an Israeli.
What an incredible, significant thing happened with these Abraham Accords. But most Americans don't know about it. I don't think the media covered it at all.
To cover it would have meant giving praise to President Trump.
It would have. And so they just don't talk about it. And yet here for the first time, there is this semblance of order and, if not friendship, at least an alliance or something on the nature of it. There in the Middle East, that is a big deal.
It is so big, and you're exactly right. People don't know about it, which is so bizarre, but the media runs the show, and they don't want people to know about anything good that this president has done. They focus not on what he does, but on what he says, and they're accustomed to that with all politicians. You know, nobody's paying any attention to what the Democratic candidate has done in his life. All they're paying attention to are the things he says. And so they're accustomed to that. Here we have a president right now who what he says can be safely disregarded. It's of no importance. But pay attention to what he does.
Let me ask you another question related to this general topic. What is behind the exponential rise of anti-Semitism, not only in the United States, but really around the world? What's driving that?
What's driving it is the war against civilization. The problem with Jews and Christians is that they stand for civilization. Civilization's just another word for the way of human coexistence built by the Bible. And Jews are the original source of that information. And that's all it is. Israel as a focal point of civilization in a barbaric region is singled out for special mistreatment and abuse. And the hatred for America as being the most biblical country on the planet comes in for its own share. So anti-Americanism and anti-Semitism are exactly the same thing. It's no accident that on some of the Arab streets, you will see Israeli flags and American flags being burnt alongside one another. It makes no difference.
It's been going on for thousands of years, not only in Nazi Germany, but in Russia, in nations around the world. There's got to be some driving force behind it. Can you help us get a handle on that? Why now? Why now?
Because the Titanic struggle, as I've called it now, is between barbarism and civilization. And the barbarians sense that they are closer to victory than they've ever been since World War II. And so, you know, when you get a chance to riot in the streets and loot stores and set places on fire, and all that happens is that left-wing political leadership obsequiously calls it legitimate protests, then that's giving you the green signal to hate everything that is golden, to hate everything that is positive, to hate everything that is civilized, to hate everything that is biblical, to hate everything that is godly. And sure enough, that's exactly what they've done. This is true in other parts of the world as well. There is good reason. If you were on the side of the barbarians, you'd be feeling very good right now. You'd feel, hey, we're close to victory. We nearly pulled it off in 1917 with the Russian Revolution. We've nearly pulled it off in World War II with the fascist revolution. We're getting somewhere. We own the universities. We own American public schools. Hey, it's only a matter of time. We're winning.
That's a terrifying thought to me.
But it is true.
Because it hinges on the next election. Again, I don't want to be real political here, and I really can't, but that is of great concern to me. Let me turn the corner and talk about marriage. You had a lot to say about marriage in culture and the role that it plays. Why is it crumbling all around us?
Marriage, for the most part, is a creation of biblical culture. Marriage is not something that would have evolved naturally. There are fewer families being formed, and that is the tragedy. Part of the auxiliary damage done by a secularizing society is a decline in marriage. It's inevitable. There is a wonderful sociologist, Joseph Daniel Unwin, who was very highly regarded until the 60s began, and this attack on Western civilization, on men, and on the family began. But Joseph Daniel Unwin points out, and he's 100% correct, if you check his numbers and the facts, there has never been, in the history of 5,000 different cultures on the world, there's never been a single successful one that didn't have a biblical model of monotheistic and monogamous marriage. There's never been. So, yes, I don't think there's any question about it. I don't think any serious scholar could in any way argue the point that marriage does appear to be absolutely fundamental and quite indispensable to the maintenance of a civilized society.
You know, it's really interesting that you bring up Unwin's name. My first book for the family was called Dare to Discipline, and I quoted Unwin there saying that not one civilization that wasn't based on those values and that understanding has survived. They've all disintegrated. And I was really quoting the same study you're talking about there.
Yeah.
You have talked with some intensity about cohabitation and opposed it vigorously. Explain why.
I think we probably agree. First of all, from a woman's point of view, and I speak about this on my podcast very often. I had one episode a few months ago called, "Hey Girl, You Do Not Want to Be His Girlfriend." You know, there are very limited statuses for a woman. Single, wife, divorced, and widow. Those are the statuses of a woman. Girlfriend is not a status. Partner is not a status.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I mean, as the father of six daughters, it's obviously something that I've had to deal with and I've thought about long and hard. It is not in a woman's interest to cohabit. First of all, if you say, well, they'll get married afterwards, some do, some don't. But as everybody knows, the marriage statistics of couples that have cohabited are much worse than the regular marriage statistics. The likelihood of divorce of couples who live together before marriage is quite high. And that makes sense when you think about it. So that's one thing. It's just not in the interests of a woman. It's a mistake.
And it's certainly not in the best interest of the child who's likely to be conceived.
Yeah, no, it's a disaster for the child. I mean, it's an almost guarantee into the worlds of poverty and crime, almost a guarantee. And then from the point of view of a man, you know, I put it this way, the amount of energy that most men are willing to expend and able to expend in pursuit of their own gratification is limited. There's a certain point. And again, let's take it as a given that having a man work hard in the economy is good for everybody, right? I'd rather have a man working in the economy than having a man go into politics. Because if he goes into politics, that only guarantees 10 more fingers in my wallet. But if he goes into business, it's one more person trying to think of ways to make my life better. And so the amount of work that a man is willing to do to gratify his own needs is fairly limited. But the amount that a man will do to take care of somebody he loves is almost infinite. And that's why all the time men die defending their love runs. They're literally willing to give up our lives. That's what we're willing to do. And so when I am given the privilege of supporting a wife who's perfectly capable of supporting herself, but she says, I am willing to be your wife and the mother of your children and to make those matters my priority, then I am privileged to support her. And all of a sudden, my energy and creativity get a kick upwards by an order of magnitude. I'm 10 times more effective at that point. And so that's part of the explanation for why men do need marriage desperately, even though most of us don't actually realize it until much later.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Shirley and I just celebrated our 60th wedding anniversary, and I've had the opportunity to do many things that have been exciting to me. I've enjoyed my life. Doors have been open to me, but there's nothing that I have done that comes anywhere close to the pleasure that I've gotten out of loving one woman, taking care of her, being responsible for her welfare, and doing everything I could to make her happy. That is the crowning achievement of my life, if I have achieved it at all.
It's exactly right. And it's the way the good Lord created us. We men do enjoy pleasing our women. We really do. And when they're happy, we're happy.
Well, I'm happy. Are you?
Absolutely, yes, very much so. It's as if my life as a single man, or as if they don't exist. They've been blurred out of my memory.
Well, I do understand that. Well, we agree that marriage is the centerpiece of culture. It's the ground floor. It's the foundation. Everything sits on it. And we dare not destroy it.
It is. And the problem, though, is, of course, that too many of our fellow citizens are not in any way persuaded of that. And so I sometimes scratch my head trying to ascertain, you know, how have I failed? In what way have I been less effective than I should have been in helping to make clear and obvious to everybody? You know, why am I so sure that marriage is an indispensable foundation of a healthy and effective society? And so many people don't believe that. So why is this just a matter of opinion? No, there's evidence of this. And yet I've not been as effective as I wish I had been in helping to make that clear to everybody.
If you need evidence of the critical role played by good fathers in a family, take a look at the generation raised in fatherless homes. That is a sad picture, and the statistics all point in one direction. When you look at the lost kids growing up on the street, there's something there that's not right.
The thing, I mean, our mutual friend, the late, great Chuck Colson, told me the story, which I'm sure he's told you as well, that once they went into the prisons to try and help prisoners send Mother's Day cards as a kindness. And it was a big success. The program was hugely successful. And so a few months later, they went back to the prisons to get the prisoners to send Father's Day cards to their fathers. And they made the discovery that almost anybody with a few years of experience in law enforcement already knows, and that is that a very high proportion of people incarcerated never knew their dads.
I believe we have time for only one more area of common interest. You wrote an article, a powerful article that's been widely circulated, in which you said, historically, great empires have a shelf life, and it usually lasts no longer than 250 years. You're talking about the Roman Empire. I mean, you go all the way back in history, that's been the record. That's been what's happened. And looking at the ancient history in that way, it turns out that it applies to current, more contemporary cultures as well. You drew the conclusion that if that analogy works, those data apply to us, that we could be in the final 6 years of our existence. You want to elaborate on that?
Yeah, sure. It's absolutely correct. I mean, from ancient history, the Babylonians, the Ottomans, the Romans, everybody, it's about 250 years. You know, you can quibble a little bit, 245, 270, but it's 250. If you drew a graph, the line would come down on 250 years. And that means we do have about another 6 years. If that is, and again, you know, quibble with me and tell me it's another 12 years or 15 years, it's fine, doesn't matter. The way you phrased it is exactly correct. Are we on the final lap? And it's not to say that life would just stop. The Roman Empire is long gone, but there are plenty of people living in Rome. It's just that Rome just has no influence in the world and no power. And it's actually a lot nicer and a lot healthier to live as a citizen of a country that does have power and that is surviving and thriving. So it would be a real shame if that happened here. There is really no reason to suppose it wouldn't. And the mechanism is not hard to see. Essentially, the affluence that is produced by a successful civilization ends up corroding the very values that made that civilization possible in the first place. So, you know, is that where we are? It might be. And really, the only civilization that has escaped that dire end is Israel.
Yeah, that's the point. Israel's 4,000 years.
Yeah. So to whatever extent America is able to return faithfully to the covenant under which the founders put it, that they become part of that same covenant, to that extent, we stand a chance of escaping history's fate.
That is so powerful, and it speaks to where we are as a nation right now. If we abandon those things that made us great, we have a short shelf life too. And I just pray that our people will wake up while there's still time to preserve it.
Right.
My guest today has been Rabbi Daniel Lappin. He's an Orthodox Jew and a very personal friend of mine for many years, at least 25. And despite our theological differences, we share a spiritual heritage in what Christians call the Old Testament, and he would call the Torah. And because of that common heritage, we have many shared views. And we've been talking about some of them today. Rabbi, it's such a pleasure to have you on the program. I've enjoyed the conversation, and I hope we can do it again.
I look forward to that, Dr. Dobson. Would you please convey my respects to Mrs. Dobson as well? I haven't seen her for the last 3 or 4 years, but please know that she's in my heart as well as in my wife Susan's.
If you ever come through Colorado Springs, you drop by for a visit. I'll make sure that she's there.
You know we will.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
You're most welcome. Good to be with you.
An enlightening discussion about the moral similarities and concerns of the Jew and the Christian. We hope you've been blessed and informed by this two-part conversation. If you missed part one of this interview, or you'd like to revisit the entire discussion, be sure to request a broadcast CD of both programs. Simply go to today's broadcast page at drjamesdobson.org and click on the Order a CD button. While you're there, you can also learn more about Rabbi Lappin as well. Find all of this and more when you go to drjamesdobson.org and then click onto the broadcast button. You know, the issues discussed yesterday and today are so very critical to our way of life. The attacks on marriage and faith should cause us to pay attention to rising hostility in our country. Are you prepared to vote to protect morality and biblical values? If you need a resource for reference, be sure to request a copy of Dr. Dobson's helpful publication called Faith Votes. This free tool highlights several critical issues at stake in November. Be a fully informed Christian voter and ask for your copy of Dr. Dobson's Faith Votes resource. You can do that by calling 877-732-6825. That's 877-732-6825. Or by going to drjamesdobson.org/faithvotes. That's drjamesdobson.org/faithvotes. Well, that's all the time we have for today. Be sure to join us again tomorrow and Friday on Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk. I'm Roger Marsh. Thanks for listening.
This has been a presentation of the Dr. James Dobson Family Institute.